The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. I like to think of this as an empowerment hour because we cover so many different issues, always with the idea of helping us to understand how we can live happier and healthier lives. Today, from our environmental corner, we'll talk about how forests absorb one-third of our fossil fuel emissions, but what can we do to increase our forest? I believe that we could have a national program, much like what FDR did in the 1930s, the Civil Conservation Corps, but we could replant America. Think of all the unemployed in cities that we could ask, hey, why not put 6 to 10 million new trees in every state and think what that would do to help us with our CO emissions. It would help with a lot of the watersheds that we have reduced because of urban sprawl. I'll talk about that. Then, new studies from Harvard and Tufts University build support for vitamin D as an anti-diabetic potential. Poultry farms that go organic have significantly few antibiotic-resistant bacteria. New research published in the peer-reviewed journal, the Journal of Neuroscience, shows that dementia is preventable with diet. So I'll give you that. And the missing link to prevent arterial hardening and cognitive decline. A new article from the Journal of Nutrition on what that nutrient is. From our issue segment today, the empathy ceiling. The rich are different. And not in a good way, unfortunately. This is a series of 15 studies by a professor of social science, Dasher Keltner. And I'll be sharing what happens. It's to me, when I read it, it was almost like a Depression-era Frank Capra movie. What's happening with this social class as culture convergence between those who have and have not. On the one side, you have the Ayn Rand, it is the morality of altruism that men have to reject philosophy. And on the other, along with that comes let them eat cake. But on the other, it's the idea that aren't we all human beings? Shouldn't we look at a person as a sacred soul rather than just a commodity or someone who's on a scale that we can either feel associated with or indifferent to based upon their economic standing? Plus, how a corporate Supreme Court cabal joined forces with right-wing and Koch brothers to quietly sell out our democracy. Commentary from Jim Hightower. Time permitting, J.P. Morgan food stamp monopoly. The more Americans that fall into poverty, the more money Jamie Dimon makes. Oh, and did I forget to tell you? Think of this as irony. You're a middle-class working American. You lose your job. Then you go on food stamps, and you have a problem. You call to say how that can be resolved, and a person in India is answering your call. Did they forget to tell us that when they gave these contracts to handle all of our food stamp program in the United States, J.P. Morgan outsourced it to India? What irony is there there? I'm Gary Knoll. That's our program. In the second part of our program, we'll be speaking with Professor Peter Navarro, Professor of Economics and Public Policy at the University of California at Irvine. And he is also from Harvard, where he got his Ph.D., We're going to talk to him about China's growing economic, technological strengths and military strengths, what they're doing, in effect, to colonize Africa. But now we're going to begin with a newsmaker at the top of our program, Dr. Dean Baker. He is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He is frequently cited in economics reporting in major media because of what many of us consider his very measured thoughts. He does not simply rail off. He thinks deeply on issues. He's written several books, his latest being False Prophets, Recovering from the Bubble Energy. Nice to have you with us today, Dr. Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
Dr. Baker, if you would please, I'd like to put in perspective two things, and I'll just give you a larger perspective, keep quiet, and then give you the forum to answer them for us, if you would.
Okay.
On the one hand, we were led to believe that when the Federal Reserve interjected money into the economy, it would somehow be able to help us on different levels, create new jobs, help those people who might be having trouble meeting their mortgages. Well, we just found out through the work of Bernie Sanders, the Democrat from Vermont, that the Federal Reserve somehow, without us knowing, gave $16.1 trillion to governments, to banks, to corporations, but none of that seems to have trickled down, and none of it seems to have been meant to directly help people create more jobs, factories, industries in the United States. And these people seem to have gotten this money from the best he can count at 0.25 interest, or for all intents and purposes, nothing. So why is it, on the one hand, that we have a Federal Reserve that seems to be virtually under no one's authority, control, or oversight, that can establish economic policies, and we may end up either benefiting or being victims of those policies, but we seem to have no say-so in them? If you could address that whole idea that the Federal Reserve can do all this in secret and get away with it, and no matter what the outcome. Second issue is, why is it that the only thing we're taught is that the only argument that we're allowed to think about, or we hear in the media from the left and the right, is that is the idea that we've got to cut spending, and let's cut social spending on Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and if we don't do that, that we can't balance our budget. And on the other end is the idea that we're not going to touch the military-industrial complex's budget, we're not going to touch the giveaways and subsidies to special industries, energy, coal, nuclear, gas, we're not going to touch the health insurance industry. In other words, we will let them continue in the roles that they've had in the past, but we're not going to put any of their profits or their subsidies on the table for consideration. And that's where the debate is being held by most Americans. So they're confused. So could you enlighten us on some of these issues, please?
Yeah, well, first off, with the Fed, we really owe Sanders and Ron Paul, actually, in particular, got us that information about what the Fed had done with its special lending facilities. They had given us general numbers, but we got the specifics of what they had done with that. The Fed's a mixed bag. I mean, what we need is more congressional control. This is really the laziness of Congress, because they can control the Fed, and they should control the Fed. You've had a lot of conservatives that have been trying to prevent the Fed from taking more aggressive steps to counteract this downturn, which certainly they can do. But you've had a lot of conservatives who have been yelling about inflation, that there's no inflation to speak of, and trying to prevent the Fed from taking stronger measures to help the economy. I will say, I think they have done some. I mean, we have relatively low mortgage interest rates, and that was in part because they're quantitative easing. So they had done things like that, but I think they could be much, much stronger in terms of trying to push down interest rates. I actually would like to see a little more inflation. That would, I think, be helpful in the current environment. So what we have to recognize is that the Fed is subject to congressional control, and we should take advantage of that. We should be insisting that they be more aggressive in trying to boost the economy. Now, in terms of the budget, yes, I mean, we have a lot of people who are going after Social Security and Medicare. They don't want to go after it. They want to leave the military untouched. The big stories here, Social Security is basically sound long, long into the future. The Congressional Budget Office just came out with their new projections, show if we do absolutely nothing, we can pay every penny of benefits through the year 2038. And even after that date, again, if we do absolutely nothing, we could pay over 80% of scheduled benefits. We won't want that. You want 100%. But the point is, you know, we're most of the way there even doing absolutely nothing. So this idea that, you know, it's in desperate shape, needs to be cut, this is just nonsense. And in terms of Medicare, Medicaid, that's the story of our health care system. We have a broken health care system. We pay more than twice as much per person as people do in Canada, Germany, whatever country you like. We don't have anything to show for in terms of better outcomes. And the gap is projected to grow. Our costs are rising year by year relative to everyone else's. So what we have to do is fix the healthcare system, which means paying less to the insurance industry, to the pharmaceutical industry, to the highly paid medical specialist, get our cost in line with the rest of the world, and then we don't have a big problem. But those are, you know, the defense industry's got powerful lobbies, the doctors, the drug companies, the insurance companies. So what they do is say, no, we can't do any of those things. People are just going to have to suck it up and go without health care and get their Social Security cut.
What are your suggestions for us going forward in putting in perspective the type of social spending that is necessary to help those individuals have a better pay at the end of the week? Because most Americans are saying right now that they don't have enough take-home pay from their jobs in order to help the economy because they don't have disposable income, and versus the idea that corporations want to squeeze as much profit as possible, and if it means outsourcing jobs or cutting benefits or cutting back on what people make, so be it. There seems to be a divergence of interest here.
Well, we have to improve the labor market so that people can push up their wages. So that means getting back to something resembling full employment. That's why the Fed's so important in that story. We have to get the dollar down. That will increase demand for U.S. workers. It'll make it less profitable to ship the jobs to India or wherever it might be. So those are really big measures that would go a long way. They aren't easy to do because obviously the Fed's a powerful institution. Getting the dollar down would require action by the Fed, the Treasury. I mean, these are things that can be done, but you have powerful interest groups that don't want to go that route.
I appreciate you sharing these insights. I understood you only had a few minutes, but you gave us some things to think about. I appreciate, so thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Dr. Dean Baker, newsmaker at the top of the hour. I'm Gary Nall, now the latest on health and healing, and always from original peer-reviewed journals, not out of the mainstream media. First, for people who suffer from dementia, and just 2 days ago in Los Angeles, a gentleman brought his wife to a screening and got me on the side, said, do you have anything that could help her? She has dementia. And of course, I had protocols, happy to share them. And it's sad because this is not an older person. This is a person in her 50s who was a major social activist. And now you can see one moment she's present, the next moment she's not. And here is the good news. The good news is we can prevent dementia. And how do you prevent dementia? Which generally starts to manifest in your 40s or 50s, where one of the first signs you start to lose your memory. First is short-term memory. Where did I put my keys? Did I turn off the fire when I left the house? Gee whiz, where's the other sock? I know I put two socks in the washing machine, right? And then it gets worse. I can't remember that person's last name. What was the title of that movie I saw? That's how it starts. Why? Because we have been consuming pro-inflammatory foods and beverages. Those inflammatory elements then attack the cells in the body and damage them. When you're younger, you have more cells to attack, and you also have greater recuperative power. The older you get, the less repair to the DNA, and hence you end up with damaged DNA. When you damage the DNA in the brain, especially colas, alcohol, not red wine, but alcohol sure does damage, and meats, highly cooked food, French fries, pizzas, muffins, bagels, very bad for you because those are acrylamides. When you brown anything, you have caused a change in the chemistry of what you're cooking. As a result, the toast is a good example, or pizza crust. To make that happen, you create a byproduct in the cooking process called acrylamides. Those acrylamides are not easily digested, and when you do digest them, a whole lot of inflammation occurs immediately. Now, let's say you had a pizza and a cola, or a bagel and a cup of coffee. You've just put two different types of highly acidifying, bad in itself, more likely to cause you pain, and inflammatory agents in your body. Those go to the brain and start breaking the dendrites, the little connections between your cells, so you no longer can get a cell to send a message from point A to point B, and that's your memory. So now you start affecting memory and cognition. So here's the latest, and this is from a peer-reviewed journal, the Journal of Neuroscience. I'll quote this. New research shows dementia is preventable with natural means. And then this is a Dr. William Grant who details this. For example, a lack of vitamin D in Alzheimer's and other vascular dementias. And the more green vegetables, the more fruits, the more grains, whole grains that you have, the less dementia that you have. And also, if you're sleep deprived, if you're staying up late at night, really bad for you. I cannot tell you how bad that is. Yet we have a culture now that tends to be, especially younger culture, that wants to stay up at night. That's when they do their social networking. And I'm saying that what you're doing now in social networking that's causing you not to get a good night's sleep and is taking you out of your circadian rhythms, you will pay by increased cancer and brain damage. That, in turn, brain damage, can then cause you to have not normal emotional responses. So, quote, given the high prevalence and significant morbidity associated with both sleep disordered breathing and cognitive impairment, establishing whether a prospective association exists between sleep disordered breathing and cognition is important. And then they went in to talk about the studies and showed that there's a definite correlation. So, want to live a longer life? Want to have your brain working longer? Eat your veggies, your fruits, exercise, and get good sleep. New research from the Journal of Nutrition shows that the missing nutrient in preventing arterial hardening, which is a major killer, and cognitive decline, and they generally go hand in hand, is vitamin K2. Vitamin K, as my audience would know, is known for its ability to promote normal blood clotting. And there's an enormous amount of information demonstrating that vitamin K, in its multiple forms, can provide a powerful anti-inflammatory shield to protect against many lethal diseases of aging. So, writing in the Journal of Nutrition, according to John Phillip, Natural News, it says, researchers show that vitamin K works with other fat-soluble nutrients to protect the brain from arterial calcification that leads to a stroke or cognitive decline. Vitamin K, quote, works to prevent the deposition of calcium within our artery walls and ushers the mineral toward the normal construction of bone throughout the body. The research provides proof that eating a healthy diet to maintain adequate stores of vitamin K over a lifetime can help prevent arterial hardening, atherosclerosis, and cognitive decline. And you don't need a lot of it. You only need 2 milligrams a day. That's it. 2 milligrams. Also, Harvard and Tufts University did a study that shows that the best anti-diabetic nutrient, vitamin D. Why? Because vitamin D, according to this new research shown in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, it boosts the function of the cells in the pancreas to produce insulin. That's brand new research. We've known that it does so many other good things. Helps us prevent flu and colds, keeps our bones strong, helps prevent cancer. Now we know that it also is anti-diabetic. So all of you who are overweight, all of you who are pre-diabetic and diabetic, make sure you're getting 2,000 to 3,000 units a day of vitamin D3. And finally, for those of you who do eat chicken, and that's certainly you're right, and I'm not a food cop, I'm not going to tell you what to eat and not to eat, I'm just going to show you the pros and cons of different position, and you choose. But the good news is that those who are eating organic chickens, you will have less likelihood of consuming antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Quote, this is from Science Daily, this is mainstream science. Antibiotic use in conventional animal food production in the United States has created public health concerns because it is shown to contribute to the development of antibiotic-resistant bacteria that can potentially spread to humans. A new study by Dr. Sepkota of the University of Maryland School of Public Health provides data demonstrating that poultry farms that have transitioned from conventional to organic practices and ceased using antibiotics have significantly lower levels of drug-resistant enterococci bacteria, E. coli. And this was published in Environmental Health Perspectives. So for those of you who are still consuming chicken, at the very least, consume organic certified chicken. You'll be doing yourself a lot of good on that. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Working in a coal mine, going down, down, down. working in a coal mine. Whoop, about the foot down, working in a coal mine. Going down, 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 working in a coal mine. Whoop, about to slip down.
5 o'clock in the morning, I'm already up and gone. Lord,
I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world. I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting and video streaming live in our studio in New York City. For those of you who, over the past 5 days, have seen the new film, Knocking on the Devil's Door, I'm going to give you an opportunity now to call in and share your thoughts about what you saw. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888, because a lot of people had some thoughts. And I said, okay, we'll open up the phones and give you an opportunity. Now, separately, here is our issue of the day, and I want you to call in and share your points of view on this. This is a study by a professor, Dacher Keltner, and here is what he found. Quote, the empathy ceiling, this is from commondreams.org, the rich are different and not in a good way. I'll quote this verbatim. Psychologist and social scientist Professor Dacher Keltner says the rich really are different, but not in a good way. Their life experience makes them less empathetic, less altruistic, and generally more selfish. In fact, he says, the philosophical battle over economics, taxes, debt ceilings, and defaults that are now roiling the stock market is partly rooted in the upper class ideology of self-interest. Quote, we have now done 12 separate studies measuring empathy in every way imaginable, social behavior in every way, and some work on compassion, and it's the same story. Lower class people show more empathy, more pro-social behavior, more compassion, and no matter how you look at it and how bad it is, they're simply more humane. In an academic version of this called Social Classes Culture, the Convergence of Resources in the Rank of the Social Realm, published in the Journal of Clinical Current Directions in Psychological Science, they argue, quote, upper class ranks perceptions trigger a focus away from the context towards the self. In other words, rich people are more likely to think about themselves. They think that economic success and political outcomes and personal outcomes have to do with individual behavior and their work ethic. This was done at the University of California. Your thoughts on this? Is this one of the reasons that we have people who have aligned themselves about how to fix our social problems based upon their class, their economics, their status? Give us a call, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. I'd like to hear what you have to say on this, and our phones are going to be open for you in just a moment. And this, I really like this. This is from Franz Giardo, and it's the following. The 26th Amendment, that, by the way, for this audience, that's the granting the right to vote for 18-year-olds, took only a matter of months to ratify. Why? The people demanded it, and that was 1971. That was before computers or before emails or cell phones, etc. Of the 27 amendments to the Constitution, 7 took 1 year or less to become the law of the land, all because the public pressured it to happen. I'm asking each person in this audience to think about this and see whether or not you think this is valid. This is called the Congressional Reform Act of 2011. One, something I've mentioned many times, I do not believe in tenure. I believe that that every member of Congress should only run one term, that's it, and should be allowed to have no outside financing of any kind. Two, a congressperson collects a salary but no pension while in office and receives no pay from the public when they're out of office. Congress, past and present and future participates in Social Security. All funds in the Congressional Retirement Fund move to the Social Security system immediately. All future funds flow into the Social Security system. Congress participates with the American public. Next, Congress can purchase their own retirement plan, just as all Americans can. Congress will no longer vote themselves a pay raise. Congressional raises will be lowered to the CPI or 3%. Congress loses their current health care system, all of them, and hence they must participate in the same health care system as the average American. Congress must equally abide by all the laws of the land that they impose upon all other people. All contracts with past and present congressmen are void, effective now. The American people did not make this contract with congressmen. Congress made all these contracts for themselves. Serving in Congress is an honor. It should not be a career. The Founding Fathers envisioned citizens, legislation, legislators, so ours should serve their term, go home and go back to work. So those are some ideas of myself and others. Just a way of letting people in Congress know you're not this unique group of people who are above everything. Why don't you spend a little time living like the rest of us to see whether or not that brings some perspective of humility and grace back into how you make your decisions. I'm Gary Nall. Let's take a look at some of the things up here. Let's say hello to David from New York City. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Gary, hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Now, listen, I'm on disability, and I'm calling about something else. I was going to call you about the rich,
focus on the issue at hand, David. The issue at hand is the rich. I'm happy to hear anything you have to say as a perspective on the rich.
If I want to talk to you about something else, when's a good time to call you?
I set aside time on Sunday night. The entire hour is devoted to taking on any health issue that a person has. Happy to address that at that time. But I'm happy to hear anything you have to say now about the rich. Do you have anything you want to say? Please? No? Okay. Let's say hello to Donald from New Jersey. Hi, Donald. You're on the air. Please speak up.
Hi, Gary.
Hi.
Yeah, I have a simple statement to make. It seems that the self-absorption of the rich in our country make it easier for them to back these antisocial policies towards the rest of us. It's part of the holistic reality.
Okay. Thank you, Donald. Frank from Manhattan. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Gary. Gary, I've spoken to you before about this. I would ask you to have an economist on. You've had 2 days you've had economists on, and nobody has given a historical analysis of the Federal Reserve as being a private bank. We ask questions,
okay,
why do they
hold,
do
hold
what
on,
they...
Frank.
Hello?
Let's back it up a moment, all right?
Yes.
Go over to Progressive Radio Network archives. Go back 5 weeks and 4 weeks. I did 2 one-hour specials and a two-hour special just on this topic in depth. Who owns it, how it was created, the families behind it.
But then why would you ask the questions to these? Why do they do what they do? They do what they do because they're private. They don't have to answer to anybody. We know the answers why they do what they do.
Frank,
that's how they printed $5 trillion and sent it around the world, because they're private.
Okay, it was $16.1 trillion. And the reason that I invite people on the air is not to hear myself talk. If I'm going to have a person on, it is to hear what they have to share with us. That's why I do a standalone hour on commentaries only. And by the way, it's right now the most downloaded program in radio in the United States of any show. So people are listening, but there is a whole history of 3 hours just on the subject of who controls the Federal Reserve, who is behind it, how it works, how it impacts the economy and us. So everything that is in your question, a completely legitimate question, and I thank you for calling in and raising it, is there for you to study. Now, this coming Monday evening, I will be doing a 5-hour special. On what topic? On In the Name of Democracy, Freedom. I am looking at the United States' interventions in the last 200 years around the world. Just as we said we were going into Iraq so that they could have democracy and freedom and overcome tyranny, and in Libya, and in all these other 190 episodes that we've engaged in, I excluded World War I and World War II, but all the others I've included, And I have done a lot of research on this. There's a great deal of scholarship involved, but it will take me 5 hours to give you a complete history lesson on how we got to where we are, where virtually every major dictatorship, every major oligarch, every major corrupt regime we end up supporting, not for freedom and democracy, not to liberate the people from tyranny, but actually creating greater tyranny. This is an important show to listen to, either live or over the internet. I'm doing it this coming Monday, starting at 7 p.m. and going to midnight. Please tune in. I've been spending an enormous amount of time. I even brought in outside researchers to verify my facts to make sure that my history is 100% correct. So that's that issue to deal with. Okay? Let one more call. Let's say hello to Liddell from Brooklyn. Hi, Liddell. You're on the air. Please speak up.
Hi, how you doing, Gary? My name is Liddell.
Yes.
I have a quick comment. I would like to say some of the rich are pathologically greedy, and I think that greed should be looked at as a disease, a mental disease. And that's all I want to say.
Okay. I would ask you, instead of looking at that as a mental disease, pull back for a moment and look at it as a behavior with consequences, meaning that as you change your behavior, as you change your perception, you then have a different outlook. And as you gain fame, power, money, security, it can change our perception of other people. We then can look at other people as being lazy and not a part of the success mindset and not motivated as we may have been. That isn't a disease. That is a false projection upon other people, I believe. I thank you for sharing your thoughts, though. And I'll take one more. And Daniela from New York City. Hi, Daniela.
Oh, hi, Gary. My opinion about this, about the rich, first of all, I feel that how can these people empathize with anything when they don't know anything about sacrifices, they don't know about poverty, and the fact that everything is based on material and money, that makes them feel that they are a privilege, that they are privileged. Therefore, they just take it as that.
Okay, you've made some valid points. Let's just broaden the perspective for a moment. Think of the people who actually are rich and successful in what they do, who do have compassion, who do set aside resources to help other people. Look at Mr. Mott, one of the members of the dynasty. Look at some of the Rockefeller children who decided to break ranks with David and Nelson and Winthrop and to support social movements. We have to look at what has a person actually done to make it a better world. Writing a check to a charity is not the answer. That's a nice way to appease our conscience that we did something. But by going out and putting ourselves on the line, by risking arrest, by risking confrontation, and by being put on someone's blacklist or security list, I think shows that it doesn't matter what money we have, what resources we have, we're still coming from a spiritual place. I don't believe that money in and of itself is the issue, because you can do good with money, as many people throughout history have, irrespective of whether they come from a conservative or liberal perspective. It is, what do I do with the resources I have to make it a better world, not just for myself, but for other people? And we must always allow that for the equation. Otherwise, we deal in black and whites, that all rich are bad and selfish, narcissistic, because I can show you people who are not rich are narcissistic. I can show you a lot of people who have nothing materialistically but don't care about the world they live in and don't have empathy for those. I could show you union members, and I'm a union member. I can show you union individuals who will go on strike for their specific union but will not go across the street and support someone else who is suffering against social and in social oppressive means to take the power of their union movement and co-join it with another, just like in Detroit, in Wisconsin. I said this many times. I would have loved to have seen the 125,000 strong who were rightly protesting the lack of collective bargaining
and take those 125,000 people and join arms around people's around federal buildings and state buildings that were engaged in giving disposition notices to get throw people out of their apartments and homes, and to protest malnutrition and make it an issue. If 125,000 teachers made hungry students an issue, then it would have been an issue. We would have all had a chance to see the problem and the solution. And I thought it was rather ironic that who better than many compassionate teachers who see kids coming to school hungry because their parents can't afford food, and some of those students are actually homeless. Are you aware that one in every 250 children in the United States is homeless? Do you realize that there are countries in the world that have more homeless, less homeless, like the Philippines, than we do in the United States? Did anyone ever think that American teenagers would actually be on the streets in vast numbers, almost 2.5 million? Have you ever heard that figure before? And yet, wouldn't you think that the teachers would be the first to jump in line and say, this is an issue equal importance to our own collective bargaining? Helping a child that has no home, that is malnourished, that is frequently sexually and physically abused, that has no caregivers in the society? But that doesn't seem to be an issue for anyone in America, because there's no protest, there's no movement. So again, I can tell you that the whole movement becomes selfish and self-absorbed if all they're looking to do is care for their own interests and not anyone else's. Do not think because a person protests with their group for one cause that somehow they are universally affected for a higher benefit to humanity. I thank you very much, Daniela. It was a very important insight that you gave us, and happy to hear it on the air. Joining me in studio before we go to our guest is Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hey, good afternoon, Gary. I've been wanting to ask you about the London and the English disturbances going on right now. When you look at it from an outsider's point of view, there are so many different levels, and you can understand so many different points of view, and it becomes quite confusing because you don't know where the truth lies. But from a progressive point of view, looking at the overall and the history, what would you like to say to address it, please?
First, I believe that people should go to last night's Bill O'Reilly and listen to what he said, his perspective. He has a right to his perspective. I do not deny that. But it was all about social anarchy. Will it come here? These are hoodlums, and look at what they're doing. It's violent, it's bad. And that's a perspective. As a progressive, as a humanist and spiritual person, I don't see that as the issue. I first ask, why would someone want to create that kind of havoc? So separate out the havoc that is being created from its underlying causes. And there, having gone to England many times, dozens of times, and you having lived and being a native of England, and having lived in London, you may or may not have the same perspective. Historically, and it was the same in France, the French, during their major bubble and urban planning and urban building, brought in all these people from Algeria and other former colonies, and they had them work, do the actual manual work. But then they ghettoized them. They did not allow them to integrate in the rest of society. They had a place where they had to live. They had certain social subsidies, but they were not given equality with the average French person. Their schools were not good, and no one cared about them. And so finally, it was not the older, it was the youngers who rebelled. And then, oh, you mean we have a problem? Yeah, the car burning on the street is not the problem. It is what caused it, the underlying mindset that says, if you're not going to pay attention to me as you didn't pay attention to my parents, unlike my parents who are socially adaptive and passive, I will not allow you to treat me this way. And hence they rebel. Because that rebellion, the French people were forced, even through their elitist mindset, to look at what they had thrown into the closet and dustbin of French history. The abuse that has been endemic in the French soul for so long that the French people in mass never rose up and protested their taking over of Vietnam. We forget that. And in Algeria and other colonies, and how they treated people. Now go to England. England was the most formidable colonial imperial power in the world. Was it not said that the sun never sets on the British Empire?
Right.
And think of Lloyd George, and think of all the people who understood the consequences, but look at all the people that participated in it, like Winston Churchill and his association with Cecil Rhodes and the Boer Wars and all the other conflicts. Now bring it up to date. Who are these people protesting? Who are they?
A lot of black youths.
Yeah. And what opportunities of black youth? What is the unemployment rate for black youth in London?
Very high.
Let's try 55%. What do you think would happen if the average Caucasian middle school or even educated school individual had a 55% unemployment rate? Would they do anything or nothing about being penniless and none of their interests being served? What do you think would happen?
They would end up uprising, I think.
Let's take two very well-known young men in England. Who are the two most famous young men in England?
Well, not so young now. Hugh Grant, maybe, and Colin Firth. I can think of the two.
Well, I can think of two more famous ones.
Okay.
The two brothers who are the crown princes.
Oh, yeah, right.
Okay.
Yeah, William and Harry.
William and Harry. What if they, with their education, but without money, had to live in the same ghetto mindset? How long, with their temperament, how long do you think it would have taken them before they were in the streets?
Right.
So the only reason some people are not in the streets is because of economic and social circumstances and conditioning. But if you live in another person's shoes and you see that none of your authentic needs are there, nor is there any sustainable future for you, or no future at all, so no matter what the call is, you're always last to be called. If there's jobs, if there's education, if there's any social program, you're last in line because you're not considered one of us.
Right.
That type of social, ethnic, and cultural exclusion can only lead to protest. It is unfortunate, it is regrettable that the protests become violent. I wished it were not violent. So the violence I condemn, but the energy of oppression to these people, I do not. They have every right to protest. But the youth of today are not led by Gandhi. This is not a salt march through India. All right, so you do not have spiritual leaders leading the people today. So in the Arab uprising, the spring uprising of 100 million, it was not the older people, it was the youth. Right now in Israel, Israel has the largest social revolution in the world per population. Over 350,000 Israelis, mainly young. But not a word is being said about the social uprising. They're not talking at all about the Palestinian issue, settlements. They're talking about how the Israeli middle class is being deprived of an opportunity to have a sustainable future because of cost increase and 56% increase in the cost of rents and food. And yet we've given it billions of dollars. So the issue is, what happened to the billions each year that goes to Israel? It goes to the multinational corporations in Israel and the Israel Defense League. It does not go to make the Israeli people better, healthier. And so now they're protesting. And do you see the major media covering this?
No.
No. And so there's major protest. It is the first major protest of its kind. And I believe that it's a good thing, because when the Israeli youth, and this is mainly Israeli youth and tent cities, when they start to protest against equality in their own country, against a small minority ruling elite, Netanyahu, then from there the dialogue will broaden. And my hope is that in this movement for equality amongst the Israelis, there will also then say, you know, we're fighting for ourselves today. Cannot we not take an honest and objective look at the Palestinian issue? It can evolve to that. It hasn't yet. It's not even on the table. So all of these are led by youth, and almost all of them are because of social inequalities. We just haven't seen it in America yet. Yet Bill O'Reilly doesn't want to see that dialogue in the United States because it scares him.
Right. Thank you very much. And I mean, do you think there's any future? Because all the authorities and the government keep saying is it's criminals, criminals.
No, there is no future because they're using the same mindset of throw them in jail, lock them up, as we do in our society.
Right.
They've taken the wrong approach, which will only make it last longer and become more violent.
Right.
All right? That's the problem.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Let's go over and say hello to my guest standing by, Professor Peter Navarro, Professor of Economics and Public Policy at the University of California, Irvine. He received his doctorate in economics from Harvard and has worked as a policy analyst for the Department of Energy and taught at several universities. And he is also the author of the new book, Death by China, Confronting the Dragon. By the way, that defines much of the darker side of China's global strategy. Nice to have you with us today.
My pleasure.
There's so much that I am interested in covering, so we're going to get started today, but I'm going to look forward to having you back for an extended interview. Would you begin by taking a look at how we have treated China in our official policies, the imbalance that we have in our relationship with China and not being able to address any of its major environmental issues, human rights issues, even pirating issues, faulty manufacturing issues, because we are so indebted to them? What impact does it have when the person we're going to ask money from to continue our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, etc., if we say anything they don't like, they could adversely affect our economy? Your thoughts, please.
Well, first of all, it's a horrific day, horrific week in the stock market, and it's very clear that the economy here in the U.S. and globally is going into another recession, which will be our third in 10 years. And the China connection is simply this. For the last 11 years since China joined the World Trade Organization, this country has been running huge trade deficits with China that cumulatively have turned into a more than $3 trillion debt. Now, what everybody listening to the show has to understand is this. When we run trade deficits, that shaves points off our economic growth rate. And China has cost us about one growth point a year for the last decade. And that's about 1 million jobs a year. Cumulatively, it's about 10 million jobs. And if we had those jobs right now, we wouldn't be having a stock market crash. We wouldn't have 25% effective unemployment and 10% unemployment posted. And it would be a very different world. And the reason why we run those trade deficits is very simple. China engages in widespread predatory, mercantilist, and protectionist practices that over the last decade have led to the hollowing out of our manufacturing base across this great country. And now we have 10% of people working in manufacturing rather than 25%. We no longer produce what we consume, and it is what it is. And we've got a very difficult road ahead of us unless we confront this dragon that's essentially destroying our manufacturing base and economy.
I appreciate that insight. Just a thought. I have many, many major activists in China that I communicate with. They tell me that China is quietly becoming the leading imperial power in Africa, that they tend to colonize Africa, but not in the words of colonization or imperial overreach, but simply they are buying the country by buying resources, mineral resources, including oil and minerals that they need manufacturing and farm. And they've been doing it there. They're also doing it in South America. They are making deals around the world, and they have unlimited amounts of money, it seems, to do this. But at the end of the day, once they have gained a foothold and a system is in place, they bring in over 1 million people going into China, 1 million people who are Chinese going into Africa, and these are technocrats. They are highly skilled, highly disciplined, and they speak only through the Communist Party or the Central Planning Party and the Politburo.
Your thoughts? I think it's a little worse than that. I've got a whole chapter in the Death by China book called Death by the Colonial Dragon, and it traces this issue of colonialism in Africa and other places. But it's not just technocrats. I mean, here would be a typical scenario for the Chinese. Tanzania. They'd offer the Tanzanian government a bunch of loans to go in and build whatever, maybe a railroad, maybe some roads, maybe some infrastructure. And in exchange for that loan, they would get access and ownership of Tanzania's natural resources. And then rather than create jobs in Tanzania, what the Chinese will do is bring over their own laborers. So it's not the technocrats. They bring their own laborers as well. And in addition, they will do things like buy agricultural land and actually import Chinese farmers. So yes, Africa is becoming a colony of China, but guess what? I mean, the state of Idaho is cutting a similar deal for a Chinese industrial and agricultural park that would be self-contained and serve only the Chinese. I mean, we with our debt are selling our country just like the Africans are selling their country.
I don't think people fully appreciate the
They don't. I mean, you would be outraged if you fully understood the magnitude. I mean, it sounds like science fiction, the idea that China could use their debt to go in and buy essentially part of Idaho, which is what they're doing. But, I mean, if you look at Stephen Colbert, he's joking about them hauling off Kansas to Guangzhou. You look at Jimmy Kimmel two nights ago, he's talking about selling Florida to China to pay off our debt. I mean, this stuff is real. And people in America, when they go into Walmart, simply are sleepwalking when they pick up stuff that's made in China, and they don't realize they're basically putting a down payment not only on their own unemployment, but also on mortgaging their country. You just want to get up on the top of the Capitol Hill building and shout this stuff out, but nobody's paying attention. I don't get it. I mean, that's why I wrote Death by China. I'm trying to get people to pay attention.
Another thing, I'm sure you're familiar with the new Rural Council of 22 agencies that the Obama White House created, and three of those agencies are the CIA, Homeland Security, and the Defense Department, along with other departments, Bureau of Land Management, where they are wanting to take 16.2 million acres of land that is now public commons lands out in Utah, Idaho, Wyoming, Montana, and do what they're calling, in a positive a flip of the concept, a public and private relationship to enhance economic growth. The bottom line is they want to sell these rights off for mineral rights, China in Idaho for coal, and others to do hydrofracking, and they're selling this as something good for America. Right now as we speak, however, they have been closing off roads. They have been denying access to public places because they're starting to prepare all this, what they see as being good for America. Are you familiar with this?
Well, look, I mean, here's my perspective on all of this. We have a president who basically, with his policy towards China, has just been just like the previous precedent, which is high irony. I mean, you're progressive. You would have thought Obama would come in and have different trade policies with China than George Bush, but it's the same old crap from both administrations. And basically, my message to the American people right now is that the best jobs program we can have is not spending a bunch more money for fiscal stimulus or cutting taxes for corporations, but it's trade reform with China so that we can get our deficit down and put the people of Ohio and Pennsylvania and California and upstate New York back to work in factories to generate income and wages, and so they can buy stuff and revenues for the government. I mean, and all this other stuff that you're talking about.
Okay,
it's just a sideshow to me.
But Peter,
a distraction.
Peter, I'd like for you to take us in this direction for a moment, please. By the way, I just want to mention to our land-based stations, terrestrial stations, you'll be going off in a moment. You can continue to watch and listen to this program with Professor Peter Navarro, who is the author of a very important book on China called Death by China, by going to progressiveradionetwork.com, where we'll continue this discussion. Now, here's an idea. Please explore it with us. on the one hand, what you're saying, bring jobs back to the local communities, reindustrialize America with people having a living wage. That's exactly opposite of how Wall Street and the financial houses see the best way of making money. They want to make money different ways.
Wall Street and the financial houses are making money off China. I mean, the way this works is you got GE or Caterpillar or GM or Intel basically going over to China, taking their factories over there, using the cheap labor, using the ability to pollute the environment, picking up checks from the Chinese government for subsidies. They go over there, Wall Street underwrites the whole damn thing, and Main Street gets screwed. I mean, you know, it's an old story, but the new twist on it is that this is not small stakes anymore. This is actually destroying our country. This is destroying our country. And so, you know, we need to wake up. You know, I watched the Tea Party do their thing, and it's like, hey, Tea Party, why don't you understand that it's not about taxes? What it's about, trade. It's about trade reform. And on the left, the progressive, whatever. I mean, I see Paul Krugman get on the tube and want to spend more government money to dig us out of this thing. No, it's trade reform. It's trade reform and it's trade reform.
Then then explore that a little further. Currently, import $1 billion a day.
Manipulation. You're in New York, right?
Yes.
Senator Chuck Schumer always flaps his lips about currency reform, but China basically undervalues its currency by manipulating it, and basically the manipulation leads to a 40% undervaluation of its currency. Now, how does a steel maker in Ohio compete with a steel maker in China when right off the bat the steel maker in China's got a 40-cent edge on a dollar? I mean, it's outrageous, and we put up with that, and Obama, when he was in Ohio, he campaigned on that. He said, hey, I'm going to crack down on that. And the first thing he does when he gets into office is back off on that promise. And then we get currency manipulation. And it's crazy. I mean, that's a huge advantage. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, you go over to China and set up as a multinational your facility over there, and they give you a huge check for everything you export back to America as a government subsidy. So here's the thing you got to understand. All of this stuff violates World Trade Organization rules. It's illegal. And we, as the U.S. government, have the ability to crack down on all of this. But that government in Washington is bought and paid for by the big corporations who are making out like bandits in China, and we get what we get. And I mean, it's nuts. I mean, you can talk about all these other issues in the world right now, whatever turns you on. But at the end of the day, if we don't have a job to pay us a decent wage so that we can survive, we don't have anything in this country. And that's where we're moving.
Okay. I appreciate your independent thought on this, because you're breaking ranks with so many other of the either the left or right, which I consider part of the problem. They're talking like ideologues, and you're talking as an independent thinker. I just have two more questions, please.
Sure.
One is, I'm very concerned about how much power the Federal Reserve has to print money with no accountability and to give that money at 0.25% interest, which is almost zero, to major corporations. And only now, recently, did we see the documents, the 22,000 transactions involving $16 trillion was given, $2.3 trillion to Citigroup, and Bank of America got $1.7 trillion, and we weren't told any of this. What are your thoughts about the power of the Federal Reserve and its non-accountability?
For everybody out there listening, I got a website, peternavarro.com. I do a weekly investment type newsletter, which comes at it from the perspective of just analyzing the economy and its relationship to individuals in America. Okay, and so, I mean, you know, for years now, I've been saying that the Fed has too much power to go out and basically print a bunch of money and get this country into debt. Now, the good news is they're out of bullets. They shot every bullet they had in their arsenal, every single one, and it has not worked.
Well, it worked temporarily yesterday.
Yesterday's meeting with the Fed basically was unilateral surrender. It was basically, hey, we can't do anything more. And so, I mean, I'd be a lot more worried about other branches of government right now not acting than the Fed, because the Fed basically has been neutered. I mean, okay. The Fed, you know, I mean, it's, you know, Bernanke was Alan Greenspan's fall guy. I said it at the time he got appointed, because this housing bubble was going to collapse, and Bernanke has done everything wrong. And so, you know, I mean, but it's over. The Fed is a neutered entity here in American economics and politics.
I hope so, but remember, a rattlesnake without a head can still bite you.
It's more like, to me, it's more like a donkey, and you know what the other word for that is.
Yeah. Last question.
Sure.
You document very meticulously the dangerous and life-threatening products that the U.S. and Europe imports from China, like exploding cell phones and lead in toys and toxic drywall and various chemical poisonings seriously affecting our health and faulty auto tires. Give us a few examples that you find especially disturbing, and how is it that China managed to get away with it and convince our importing companies and officials on the safety of products coming out of China?
Well, one of my buddies says, you know, if you put it in your mouth or you touch it, don't buy it from China. And I think that's right. The problem with toxins in China, Chinese-made products, are twofold. One is you got an unnatural problem in that they're the most polluted country in the world. Soil, air, water. Toxic zones. Okay, so that inevitably is going to seep into the fish they sell us, which they're the biggest exporter of fish to this country. That's going to get into the toys and other products they sell us and all of that. But the other thing you have to understand is they have a habit of what I call in Death by China book product adulteration, which is the willingness to substitute inferior and often deadly ingredients into a product to make a few extra pennies on it. That's how our heparin supply got contaminated here in America and people got killed because of that. That's how our pet food got contaminated and thousands of pets got killed here in America. That's how in China the baby formula and milk gets contaminated and 300,000 babies were sickened and their kidneys damaged. So, you know, how does that happen? Well, we don't have an FDA anymore, and you know, we buy Chinese stuff without looking at it. I mean, look in the mirror.
Peter, thank you very much. I really appreciate your insights. I look forward to another conversation.
My pleasure. Take care of yourself.
Professor Peter Navarro, N-A-V-A-R-R-O, Professor of Economics and Public Policy, University of California at Irvine, also a Ph.D. in Economics from Harvard University, and a policy analyst at the Department of Energy. He's taught at several universities, the author of Death by China. I'm Gary Noll. I want to thank you all for listening today. Go to our archives if you want to listen to the Progressive Commentary Hour, as 120,000 people did last week. That's the most downloaded internet radio program in the United States, and I have a five-hour special coming at you on giving you a whole lesson in the history of how we insert ourselves into foreign governments' policies and what it does to the people in those countries. Tomorrow, is it simply our blind faith in modern technology and free market capitalism, a monotheistic religion and materialistic cynicism that is murdering the planet's ecosystems? Or are these the fundamental defining characteristics of our Western civilization that is the real culprit for making life on Earth unsustainable? Tomorrow, radical eco-philosopher and environmental activist Derek Jensen, who in the words of late Howard Zinn is one of the rare and original voices of sanity in a chaotic world, will be on the program to challenge the predominant Western beliefs that there is no knowledge outside of what can be validated using the tools of science, and how it is that our very fundamental fabric of the building blocks of Western civilization are the greatest threat to the future of humanity. And then, on Friday, Richard Cage, the chief architect for the organization Architects, an engineer for 9/11 Truth, will be our guest to update on the most recent findings challenging the official 9/11 Commission report. Have a nice day, everyone.
Come on, girl. I remember when I used to play shoot 'em up.
Gary Null Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Tavenfeld.